In this first hour, let's talk politics with political strategist and commentator Rena Shaw. Rena, good to have you back on the program. How are you today?
Hey, I'm well. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you back. I want to talk to you for a number of reasons. There are a lot of news stories I want to work our way through in this hour. But let me just frame this properly. I had a guest on yesterday, Dr. Ron Daniels, and Dr. Daniels made a powerful point, and it's one that we all know. It's one that I really hadn't considered in the way that he framed it, particularly in this election season. But he made the point that the largest party in this country is not the Democrats, it's not the Republicans, not even the independents. The largest party in this country is the party of no voters, the party of I don't vote. And I thought about that when he said it, of course, and all day yesterday, that notion, that thought just sort of wouldn't leave me alone. I was noodling it all day. And here we are now, a day later, in this first hour talking to you. But there is a growing number, I think, of people. We shall see how these trials work out. There's more news out of the Trump trial yesterday in New York. We'll talk about that. But there's a significant number of people, and I think a growing number, of never Trump Republicans. And that particular group is also going to have some say in shaping this 2024 election. You and others I've talked to, I was on the phone in a private conversation with Michael Steele the other day, former chairman of the Republican National Committee. Michael is one of those never Trumpers, and there are others. But I want to ask a few questions about that to commence our conversation. The first question is, how are you, as one of these never Trump Republicans, watching what's happening in New York right now? Let me see this through your prism, through your lens.
Yeah, I'm watching what's happening with Trump, you know, falling asleep during jury selection on the first day of this trial. It's so historic. And it really strikes you. This is a former president, now private citizen, who expects this special treatment. But we know what this country is about. And we know that there are so many millions of Americans out there who feel like there are two systems of justice, and that the rich and powerful and certain groups of people get special treatment and others have to suffer this fate that is unfair. And so watching, again, a former president undergo what is just routinely part of how justice gets delivered in this country, it's astounding, because I am thinking about me and the never Trumpers, of how we message to people during this moment, how we talk to people about exactly who Donald Trump could be if he gets a second chance to re-enter the White House. But the questions are beyond that. The real question is, who's not voting in America, and are they paying attention? Because that's the part that I am most concerned about, to the point that you made starting off this segment. I mean, the astounding number of folks, it shocks you into almost a moment of disbelief when you're a longtime political operative like me. Like, how could we have ended up here, when you know that some 80 million Americans didn't vote in 2020. And, you know, this is deep-rooted problems. There are reasons that people have for not wanting to show up to the polls. But when you talk about bringing these people back into the fold, how do they feel connected to politics when they felt so disconnected and not represented for so long? Yes. Does this trial in New York have any bearing on them? How do we talk to them about not just the man, the character, this very bombastic moment in political history? How do we talk to them about the things that matter to them, how their life can get better when they participate in the process? So these are the questions of the moment that not just the never Trump faction of the Republican Party is grappling with. I think there are numerous groups across the spectrum that have to face this problem, because that is what parties have to do in an election year, both Democrats and Republicans, as the two major parties, because we don't have a multi-party system, even though we like to say we have one. The two major parties are tasked with turning out their most ardent supporters, but also going well beyond that. And again, turnout is the phrase of this year. So that's where every question has to come from.
And I thought I was the talk show host. Rena has just laid out a litany of questions that really are the questions that we will interrogate as we move through this hour. You're listening to Rena Shaw on Tavis Smiley.
This is getting good.
Yeah, man.
Tavis Smiley. Continues when we come forward. Helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley in conversation with political strategist and commentator Rena Shaw, who is one of those never-Trump Republicans. I like to check in with them every night again to see how they're processing what I'm processing as an unapologetically progressive fellow citizen. I want to see how others are viewing, processing what we're witnessing in real time in New York and beyond. More specifics about what's happening in that case in a moment. I can tell you that the judge yesterday seated, what, seven jurors? So these times are always off. We were told early on that they thought it might take a couple of weeks to seat this jury. And who knows, it still might. But there are other thoughts now that this jury might be seated as early as the next day or two, by the close of this week, because the judge seated and swore in yesterday seven jurors who have obviously answered, what, some 42 questions and have said that they believe that they can be fair and impartial in this case. More about that a little bit later in this conversation, I suspect. But, Rena, you raised a few questions that, you know, that we need to kind of work our way through here in this hour. And I want to go back to where I began, and that is by asking you how you're looking at this as a never-Trump Republican. And you responded by saying that it really does raise a number of fundamental questions, including how each of us messages this moment. Now, that's inside Washington, inside Beltway talk. I got a smart audience. They get it. So let me just ask you specifically for you never-Trump Republicans, how are you messaging this moment?
I would say two things. It's, you know, everything we are seeing play out in mainstream media, or really wherever you see, you get your news, wherever you get, you know, the information of the day, and you see that a former president is on trial, criminal trial. You got to remember two things, and you got to spread this message, because it's important that people think critically. And we just don't have enough of that around the country. And I think that's something that I always cared about deeply, because my parents were not educated in the United States. They both had terminal degrees from other countries. My father was a surgeon. My mother was a lawyer. They studied in other systems. And one thing that they always kind of instilled in me was this need to ask questions. And when you ask questions and you have a curiosity, you cannot be led to a certain conclusion. So we want people to make their own conclusions. But there are a couple truths here that I think the Never Trump movement is behind. And it's about the rule of law. It's about nobody being above the law in these United States, and getting that free, fair, and equal treatment that we're told is enshrined in our founding documents. And so that's really important. But also, this is not a case of a former president, when he was a private citizen, having an affair with an actress who was in pornography, and then him getting his business associates to pay her off so that affair wouldn't come to light and perhaps certain segments of folks would not be swayed by that information. Yes, it's all those things, right? But go beyond, take a step further and realize it's about election interference. Because when you're trying to dissuade the voters, you're trying to conceal certain information that would lead voters to draw a different conclusion about you. That's not just dishonest, it's straight up unlawful in how there was business fraud committed to also pay off this pornography actor, Stormy Daniels. So again, it's not a very difficult case to look at and see that there was a wrong here. He's going to be judged by a jury of his peers, like any of us would be if we were accused of criminal wrongdoing. And yes, innocent until proven guilty. But the election interference, the rule of law, those two core elements, wherever you take this in how you think about it or whatever logical conclusions you want to draw about this case that Trump faces, and the first of four, we got to remember that, yep. Right? Because he's been accused in Georgia, New York, as well as in the District of Columbia. Sorry, so this is New York, but there's Georgia, the District of Columbia, and Florida, all differing cases, differing indictments for various reasons. He's been accused of criminal wrongdoing in these other cases. He has co-conspirators who are behind bars, I must add, as well, for this former president's wrongdoing. But you got to remember, the two core elements that cannot be taken away are when people try to be above the law and people try to interfere in elections. Those are just straight up no-nos in this country.
Let me take those two things one at a time. I start with the rule of law, then we'll let me do them both. The rule of law and the election interference, because they are central to this case and to this drama that the rest of us are forced to watch with Donald Trump between now and November and beyond, I suspect. But here's my question. I'm not naive in asking this, but I want to ask it specifically of you as a never-Trump Republican. How do you, we were talking a moment ago about how never Trump Republicans message this moment. We see how Democrats are messaging it. I'm still not sure that I'm clear on how the RNC is messaging this, as this guy is set to be their presumptive nominee when they get to the convention this summer. So I'm still just watching every day to see how I think they're messaging it, whether they're doing a good job or a bad job of it, given the hand that they have been dealt by allowing themselves to have this guy. It ain't their, you know, it is their fault. They allowed this guy to become their nominee. But that said, back to the rule of law and election interference. As a never Trump Republican, how do you process that a significant slice of this party, your party, has looked the other way when it comes to, in this instance or these instances, the rule of law and election interference? How do you process that many of your party, your fellow party members, are completely looking the other way? They have raised these issues critically for years. Maybe not the second one, election interference. That's relatively new in the Trump era. But they've been talking about the rule of law for time eternal. And now when it comes to the rule of law, and again, you add election interference, they're looking the other way. How do you process that?
I mean, there's a very few ways to look at the situation that has actually been happening for 8 years, as we all know, right? The Republican Party has managed to defend Trump in so many ways. It almost feels like, wow, I didn't realize you were capable of so many explanations. And the only explanation that can be made at some point is that there are so many people who have given in to the very groupthink that they detested, the very groupthink that they accuse the other side of always engaging in. And if you want to call it a cult, you can. But, you know, look, I have said in public forums that I don't think name calling is productive. And I think Donald Trump has normalized that in this moment. So if we keep dubbing all Republicans as being anti-democracy, for example, you know, anti-American, you know, because again, they have performed mental and linguistic acrobatics, Tavis, of just a variety I cannot explain. It's not just shameful how many Republicans continue to have this former president's back when they don't have to. But you realize when you really look at how so much happened in the early years when Trump was in the White House, how so many of those people got involved in Trump world. They got involved because of the money. They started to see that this was lucrative for them. Mm-hmm. We have too much money tied to our political ongoings, whether, you know, you want to get into the intricacies of Citizens United and how campaigns are funded, or, you know, corporations being people too. In many ways, what we suffer from as a Republican Party is a crisis of conscience. If this was the party of liberty and freedom and constitutional values that are deeply rooted in illiberal principles, then you've got to be willing to talk about what conservatism is. And conservatism requires that people go deeper. People go deeper and, again, ask those bigger questions, question everything. And what you don't see right now are a great many Republican elected and non-elected officials questioning anything. They're willing to carry the water for this man because the playbook, and you remember this, Tavis, that really was kind of normalized by Limbaugh or Newt Gingrich, you know, in the post-William F. Buckley era. You've seen the demonize the Democrats playbook be the only playbook. And now what's changed is that an additional page has been added to the playbook, and it's that of screaming victimhood. Mm. So the hypocrisy is rich here in today's Republican Party. And those of us who stay, myself, and I don't want to speak for former RNC chairman Michael Steele, but I do feel pretty confident to say the group of us that has held steady over the past 8-9 years almost, we have done so because we have felt that it is important to get back to the roots of the Republican Party, which was started as an anti-slavery party, as we all know. Mm-hmm. What would Abe Lincoln say about us today? He would say, this is not his party. This is not a party that believes in those values, again, of freedom and equality, if you were going to defend somebody that has been against those very values in many ways.
Let me come back to this word. I keep wanting to go this direction. You keep throwing me off, and that's okay because I'm following you all throughout this hour. And you keep making points that I think are worthy of a follow-up and some interrogation. So let me come to this notion of victimhood. I was in a conversation with somebody about this just the other day, and so I kind of jumped when you raised when that word came out of your mouth, victimhood. So just follow me on this. You'll take my point. Ronald Reagan succeeded wildly at framing issues the way that he wanted to frame them during his time and tenure. And one of the things we all recall about that era was the way he used this notion, of welfare queen. He, you know, for those who remember that era, he, and you heard Rena invoke the name of Newt Gingrich earlier. Gingrich comes behind that Reagan era, and just, you know, with the help of Frank Luntz, they understand how to message. We were talking earlier about messaging. They understand how to message. But Reagan used that phrase, welfare queen, remarkably well during his tenure. So you think about, I want you to juxtapose these two things. The Republican Party embracing, circling around Ronald Reagan as they accuse Black America, in particular, but anything of color, of playing the victimhood game. So it was about us playing the victimhood game then. Fast forward to 2024, and Rena's absolutely right. It's now the Republicans who are playing this victimhood game. That's night and day. That's the 180, Rena. What do you make of that?
It's wild. And when you put it like that, it's so beautifully said, because we know exactly where to put the blame. And people say, well, you're a Republican strategist. I'm like, look. I'm born in the early 80s. I was a young girl when all that, you know, was getting talked about. When I read about the welfare queen sort of lexicon, you know, the stuff that went beyond that really shocked me. First of all, I come from a background that is unlike a lot of Indian Americans. My family had three generations of history in Uganda, and we were kicked out by the dictator Idi Amin. And you know, just sort of how I look at Black America is wildly different than a lot of other sort of new American populations. You know, we all know sort of colorism and how that's all sort of baked into a lot of brains, including younger folks like me who are millennials. But my look at Black America is starkly different because of my family's sort of very recent past in Africa. I look at Black Americans, I look at the civil rights movement, also, you know, coming ancestrally from India, Gandhi, you know, and Martin Luther King, like these are names you cannot invoke without thinking about how much of an impact that movement, the civil rights movement, had on present day America. And what I see in Trump and his ilk is tearing that all down. So it's not just simply using words that hit different and aren't right, or treat certain segments of our American population like lesser than. It's beyond. It's wanting to erase all the good that those movements laid into American life that we enjoy today. You know, the equality and the freedom that so many Republicans, whether they're in rural parts of the country or in urban parts of the country, these freedoms that they enjoy, they are the result of generations of people coming before even my parents immigrated here to this country. It's a result of their hard work. Trump and his people have no respect for that. Therefore, they don't just want to change the norms. They don't want to tear them down. They want to fundamentally rewrite American history. And to me, that's the scariest part. So I stay in the Republican Party because I care about having a healthy two parties at minimum. Right now, one of them is on life support, and it's no doubt the Republican Party. Any which way they spin it, this is a party that has been dwindling in size. It is a party that does not present proper solutions for the America that we all want, which is more prosperous, more competitive, more innovative. I think we all can agree that when America is those three things on the world stage, we are the superpower we were told it can be and is. But right now, there's such a crisis of conscience within the Republican Party. They can't even get any kind of words out, right? Because you've got a former president that just, again, wants to redo the American way.
It is fascinating when you think about it. I'm glad we went down this particular path, because what we've gotten for years is stop all the whining, stop all the crying, get over it, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, stop playing the victim. And you fast forward a few years, and they are the ones now who are playing this victimhood game. It's interesting to sort of process, but there's more to process. When we come forward, I want to talk about Rena Shaw's take on the fact that we are not a multi-party system. She raised that point. She's right. There are a number of independents running. Some of them you've heard as guests on this program, including Cornel West most recently, where he announced his running mate on this program. We'll talk about what it means that we aren't a multi-party system. And then there's that question that still looms, and it's getting, I think, more and more volume every day about whether or not Donald Trump can, in fact, get a fair trial being judged by a jury of his peers. We'll talk about that part and more when we come forward with Rena Shaw on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. May Fresh Daily in the Mert Park,
Los Angeles, California.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley in conversation with Rena Shaw, political strategist and commentator who I'm pleased to have back on this program. Rena is one of those never Trump Republicans, and every so often I want to check in with them to see how they are processing their way, how they're navigating their way through the moment that we find ourselves in. And as Donald Trump is on trial in New York, where the judge yesterday swore in seven jurors, we'll see what today brings, but seven were sworn in yesterday, so this thing is starting to move. The train is starting to leave the station, at least when it comes to seating the jury. But we were talking earlier, in case you just tuned in, with Rena about how the different political factions in this country are going to successfully message this moment. That's Washington talk. That's a political strategist talk, which she is. But how do these different political factions message the moment that we are in? We will see how Democrats message it. Message the moment, watching how the RNC is going to navigate its way through this process. But then there are these never Trump Republicans, and they're independents for that matter. Everybody's got to find a way to make this work for them, whatever the outcome of these trials will be. But this first one, again, we know is underway. There is this question, before I get back to the politics specifically, and this is political as well, I suspect, but there is the question, Rena, I think that's still hangs like a dark cloud, and that is whether or not Donald Trump can get a fair trial. I've said already on this program, I don't need to tell you this, you're a wise woman, you understand already where this is headed. The minute Donald Trump loses this case, he's going to blame, I suspect, the black and brown jury. He'll blame black people. He'll blame people of color for his undoing, and this will add another paragraph to the narrative he's already writing about how we're out to get him. So the question, again, still looms large in my mind, about whether or not, never mind his bad boy behavior, whether or not he can in fact get a fair trial. And I think you can't even get to that question about whether or not he can get a fair trial without addressing the issue of the charges against him. I like Alvin Bragg. I know Alvin Bragg. I consider Alvin Bragg a friend, the DA in Manhattan. And yet there are questions that are being raised about these 34 different charges. So Donald Trump writes a series of checks to Michael Cohen to give to Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet. And every time he writes a check, that becomes a charge in this case. Legally, Alvin Bragg has the right to do that. But if this happened to a black person, many of us would be saying this guy has been overcharged. And black people know this story well. Too many times in history, every day for that matter, we see black folk in this country who are overcharged by prosecutors. What's the game plan? You get it. You throw everything you can against the wall and you see what sticks. I am mad at Alvin Bragg for doing his job, but that's also a part of this conversation about whether or not he can get a fair trial and whether he was overcharged in the first place. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think in this situation, I don't find the overcharges to be the case, because I think this is just how the legal system works. I mean, certainly, I think it is true. We've seen the empirical evidence that tells us that the black and brown folks who get unfair treatment by these DAs, these overzealous DAs, suffer a different fate. And I think that's the broader conversation of me should focus on sentencing. And we're not even anywhere close to that with Trump right now. I mean, we're still very much in jury selection, top of the trial moment. And so what I'm most concerned right now about is really how the jury can see or make that logical jump again to see the wrongdoing here. The wrongdoing to me is just quite open. I mean, to me, this is a clear-cut case, and I'm trying not to look at it without any sense of objectivity. Like, I'm trying to again, look at this and say, this is somebody who's broken a law and done something that had value, which was again try to change the impression of himself. We all know that Trump has inflated his organization's wealth. We all know that he has not paid scores of small business owners and contractors to his various business entities for decades. So I think Trump has nobody else to blame but himself here. And if he thinks he can't win or he can't get the fair shake from a jury of his peers, then he knows in the back of his mind that it's all related to his own, again, treatment of the people that have been part of his community, that have been part of the businesses that he has had in New York State. And so where else can he go to have this fair trial? Does he want it to
But
be in a ruby red state like Kansas? I mean, that's just not how justice
no,
works.
I get that part. I get that part. And let me be very clear. I don't need to explain this to this audience. You will never hear me in defense of Donald Trump. I'm in defense of the rule of law. I believe in innocence until proven guilty. I believe in due process. I believe in fundamental fairness. I believe in all those things. And yet you'll never hear me defend Donald Trump. But you and I both know, let's just keep it real. You and I both know that Donald Trump ain't the first or last person to overstate his or her wealth and their holdings. Let me just go a step further. Everybody overstates their stuff until it's time to pay taxes, and then we undervalue it. Until it's time for estate planning, and then we undervalue it. We don't want to get hit. But everybody, for the purposes of getting loans, et cetera, we all bump our numbers up just a little bit. That's what people do. And I say everybody, I don't mean everybody literally, but that's the nature of the way business works. Donald Trump ain't the only person in New York who has overstated the value of his wealth, the value of his company. It happens all the time. Now, my point again is not to defend Donald Trump. Stay with me. My point is that these are the issues that he's going to be raising, has already raised, and will continue to raise between now and Election Day. He was overcharged, number one. That he would never say everybody does it, because that obviously, well, Donald Trump's crazy anyway. He could say something stupid. He does it all the time. But he wouldn't make the argument publicly, I don't think, that other people do it all the time. That wouldn't aid and abet him. But he will make the argument again that he couldn't get a fair trial because of these black folk that were on the jury. These issues are as real as rain, and I think these issues are going to play well with his base between now and November.
Yeah, I think a great deal about this because how do you, again, get through to people who don't have a lot of time and who aren't very plugged in? How do you get them to pay attention to what's most important here? And to that, I would just say, making hush money payments through an associate is just not something that every successful business owner does. And particularly given the framing and the timing and the hows and the what's, it's all related to the fact that he was running for president. And there was an evangelical base that he had to appeal to that he could have never looked 8 years into the future and realized they'd have his back no matter what. But at that time, it was on the heels of the Access Hollywood tape, which was all about, grabbing women by their private parts. I mean, this is somebody that was looking kind of at his future in the short term and saying, oh, I need to win over these evangelicals. So again, he didn't, the hush money payments is so it wouldn't come out
In
that
that
he had
tape,
this affair with Stormy Daniels.
as I read yesterday, I think that tape is being allowed in as evidence in this case. So the judge did allow that Access Hollywood tape in to the evidence pile in this particular case. Let me ask you right quick, watching my time, and we'll continue when we come forward. Never mind what I've just said. Do you think in the end that any of this matters to anybody? You are a never Trumper, but for those persons who are forever Trumpers, you think the outcome of this trial in any way matters to those persons who are already inclined to vote for him anyway?
Those people have already bought in to this whole thing of Democrats and a Democrat-backed and led sort of weaponized justice system is trying to take Trump off the campaign trail. And I mean, he's even started calling this the Biden trials. And I think that's just kind of what these people have bought into. They cannot be swayed. That line of thinking to them is logical. So you're never going to get through to those folks. But the best advice I can give to people who feel like hope is lost when they feel like there's a certain segment of people that can't be persuaded otherwise, those people are dwindling in size. I mean, the MAGA faction of the Republican Party has not grown in size. In fact, it's dwindled over the past 8 years. And now it is perhaps it sits at a moment where it's not dwindled entirely in influence, but in size it has. And in the heart of hearts of many Republican National Committee officials, they know that's the greatest problem they have. Because again, this election is about turnout.
Nope. So when we come forward, let me come to that point. You made the point earlier that that this party's on life support. And I'm reminded of a conversation that many of you've seen during one of our State of the Black Union symposia, where Minister Farrakhan and I had a conversation about just burning down the House. I want to come back to that point. Maybe it's time to burn down the RNC and build a new one. I'm not sure you can reconstruct this thing in the state that it's in right now. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about why and what it means for Rena Shaw that we are not a multi-party system. And I want to talk about her immigrant background. She mentioned Uganda and India. With all the talk about immigration in this present moment. More to cover with Rena Shaw when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
Ranked number 45 on the Heavy 100 list of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America.
Yeah.
Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
So, Rena, there's a pretty well-known story. Well, I shouldn't say pretty well-known, but I know it. Harry Belafonte, God rest his soul, was a dear friend of mine. And Mr. B told me this story more than once. He and Dr. King, who, of course, was his dear friend, Dr. King was in New York at Mr. B's home one day and said to him, Harry, I fear and fret that for all that we have done in our movement, we have integrated, I now believe, into a burning house. We've integrated into a burning house. And Mr. B looked at Dr. King and said, Doc, if you believe that we've integrated into a burning house, what then do you suggest that we do? And Dr. King said, Harry, we have to become firemen. This came up at one of our annual State of the Black Union symposia years ago. Mr. Farrakhan was on the panel, and he made the point to massive audience applause that maybe we should just let the sucker just burn down. We shouldn't become firemen. Just let it burn down and start this thing all over again. I raised that to ask you right quick, watching my time. Given that you think your party is on life support as a never-Trumper, whether or not you should just let the thing just burn down, let it die and start over again, building something new, something different, something better. Can you save
this
it?
This is one of my favorite questions because I get it inevitably every 6 months over the past 8 years. And it's, you know, it's a moment in which you have to think to yourself when you're somebody like me, do I save her? Does she want to be saved? You know, and I hate to feminize the party, but, you know, that we all know that famous line, you know, don't go saving her if she doesn't want to be saved. And that's what you want. You know, you're looking at a situation where you wonder if these people are just a bunch of disruptors who are not even just regular disruptors anymore. They're arsonists. They thrive on that. I mean, look at Marjorie Taylor Greene. Mm-hmm. It's on some level, to me, disgusting that somebody like her can make it to the highest perch of our government. But hey, this is how the system works. You know, it's imperfect. It's messy. Our representative democracy has so many ugly parts about it. And, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, somebody like her, can emerge from that. People like Congressman Lauren Boebert, Congressman Matt Gaetz. I mean, this is a trio of folks who repeatedly, even just as of this past couple of days, have made it very well known that they want to be the type of people that burn it all down if they're not getting their way. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene again saying that she wants to just get rid of Speaker Johnson. Well, what do you do if you kick this guy out? What is the alternative? They have no interest in pulling the levers of government to benefit their fellow Americans. So how do you work with people like that? You don't. You find a way to work around them.
Yeah, there's a story, of course, out yesterday, and another more stories again today, that Democrats in this instance, if they call for a vote on his speakership, Democrats may in this moment help to save Speaker Johnson. He can't afford to lose more than two defectors. He can't afford to have more than two defectors, at which point there'll be another call for another vote for a new speaker, or Democrats might save him. That's the story today. Our remaining moments with Rena Shaw when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show.
Sounds different.
Huh. This is Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley with 3 minutes remaining with Rena Shah. Rena, I got 3 minutes. I want to ask two questions. Let me start with this one. With all the talk about immigration, we still haven't gotten any real meaningful immigration reform. But being that your background is Ugandan and Indian, you say what about this conversation, this full conversation about immigration in this country?
I got to start out by saying just how disappointed I am. 11 years ago, I was on Capitol Hill as a senior staffer. I've never been in a place where I felt less hopeful about how our leaders are equipped or even have a desire to want to fix the complexities of our system. I mean, it is so complicated to immigrate here that I see why people want to jump the line. And of course, I take great issue with those who want to do that, who want to jump the line and overstay their visas, right? For example, because that's the great big problem that nobody really ever talks about. Like for all the talk that there is about the southern border and criminals creeping over from places like Venezuela, what we forget is that the system is so broken that the vast majority of the problem rests with visa overstays. Who wants to fix it? It almost feels like nobody's even incentivized to fix it. But what we know is that there is so much that migrants go through to come here. And you've got people who are fleeing, not just places where their lives are unsafe every day. You've got people who are now moving because climate is an issue.
Yeah.
You know, what we're seeing with migration related to climate is just sad. You know, food insecurity, that is sad. No child on the globe should be hungry. And yet here in America, we have child hunger that remains prevalent. So what I'm concerned about is how we bring people into this country in a way in which they can contribute to our society, help make our society better. But folks who really want to be here and just be part of the social pack, not just see America as this haven for all things free and great, because, hey, legions of people before them have enjoyed that. But what comes with a society like ours is really believing in our institutions, believing in your neighbors, and really wanting to promote freedom, liberty, and justice from the home front.
If you can top line it for me in 30 seconds, I can ask you what you make of the fact that in this election, we still are not a multi-party system.
Yeah, it's a reflection, frankly, Tavis, of how I think generations like millennials and Gen Z feel like we haven't been represented. We are disenchanted by the two parties because they haven't reflected our values for a long time. So where do you go with that? You don't go anywhere. And you sit on the sidelines and you see two big parties continue to grow in size and influence because of how the system is structured.
Yep.
I've had the great pleasure of traveling the country as an operative and meeting with people in the hollers of West Virginia or in the ghettos of certain places and feeling the same about these people, feeling the same about these children, and wanting them to see a brighter, better day in America. And we can only do that if we get rid of this two-party duopoly.
Yeah, we are just that, a two-party duopoly. And yet we shall see if these independents make a difference this time around. For now, we thank Rena Shah, political strategist and commentator. Rena, good to have you on. All the best to you. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Tavis. See you soon.
See you soon. Coming forward, a conversation with the soon-to-be former state's attorney in Chicago, Kim Fox on Tavis Smiley.